Hello, and welcome to the Locust Roundtable Podcast. Today we are podcasting with Andy Duncan. Say hi, Andy.
Hi.
And Jeff Ford.
Hello.
And Jeff, where are you actually podcasting from these days? I know, Andy, you're in Maryland, right?
I am in 124 Dunkel Hall Computer Lab at Frostburg State University in western Maryland.
Okay, and Jeff, am I right in thinking you've been moving around a bit?
Well, I'm in between place, but I'm in South Jersey today. I'll be in Ohio in January.
Ah, okay. That's what I was thinking of.
We have a place out there. I'm just getting this one ready to put on the market, and then I'm going out there.
Okay.
I have another semester to finish. You know, to finish this semester, I'm going.
Okay, excellent. So, right before we started recording, you guys mentioned, Andy, a book called Alabama Curiosities?
Yes. I wrote two editions of that. This was Work for Hire. It's a nonfiction book in a series of eccentric travel guides published by the Globe Pequot Press in New England. They have at least one volume, I think, now for every state in the Union. I know when I started working on it, they mailed me the Texas Curiosities book. And I was recommended for the job by Russ Ringsock, who is Garrison Keillor's truck driver, one of the writers on Prairie Home Companion, who wrote the Minnesota Curiosities book. But yeah, this is the idea: is you put it in your glove compartment and drive around if you're interested in seeing unusual places. Or places with bizarre historical connections, where UFO sightings happened.
Did you have to spice them up a little?
I did my best not to.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I tried to write about, say, the interstate mullet toss as objectively as I could. and the UFO Days Festival in Fife and so forth. But it was a big success. It made me world famous in Alabama. but doing the first edition taught me a lot. Doing the second edition taught me a lot because it was extensively updated and revised. I am not sure, however, that doing a third edition would teach me anything more than I already learned. So I think I'm going to use that experience on some more personal projects, maybe some more local ones, since I don't live in Alabama anymore.
Okay.
Aside the Waffle House.
That's right.
Wait, this actually leads me into something that I was thinking about, because Jeff, you wrote a little bit for the Locust Roundtable blog. You were talking about a convention experience that you had, and the way you wrote it, half the people on that list assumed you had just written flash fiction. But you swear up, down, and sideways.
I'm telling you the God's honest truth. Chris Robeson wrote in and backed me up on it. That was exactly what happened. I wasn't even making anything up with that.
But
that
again,
was absolutely true.
There's something about the style of writing a short story that sometimes you can write nonfiction and it feels like a short story.
No, that's true. I guess that's true, too. I mean, I was trying to get it as condensed as possible because, you know, I didn't want to take up that much space. It was long enough as it was, but... Well, yeah, that was absolutely true. That was... I guess it was... the guy was like Mephistopheles or something. Came out to see if we wanted to... I don't know exactly what it was about, but he was telling us that there was some like, the greatest fantasy writer of the 20th century was up in one of the hotel rooms dying.
Right.
And we was like, he was looking for somebody to finish this guy's work. And he took one look at me and Robeson was like, I could see you two don't have it.
But it's such a fascinating and bizarre encounter because you had never seen this guy and then he wandered off. And you've never
heard of him? I asked people if they knew who he was. Nobody knew who he was. Never heard of him. He was all dressed up, like, very sardonic. You know, like, he had, like, a cigarette case and everything. And, you know, this kind of, like, devil beard. It was really bizarre.
It would be fun to look up the guest list of that convention and see if we could figure out who he was talking about. But he could have just been BSing.
Well, I mean, I guess maybe he was, but, you know, we were drinking and stuff, and so I wrote to Chris, like, a couple of months later, and I said, you know, did that really happen? And he goes, you mean the guy dying by inches up in the room? He said, yeah, absolutely. And it did. Yeah, it happened, man. Somebody else who was there at the time also remembered the guy. I think maybe it was Lucius Shepard was there. I think he said, I remember that guy. So I didn't make that up at all. That was true.
The listeners of this podcast should look up how you wrote that, which is in much more detail and much more dramatically on the round table. But I think one reason that people were saying is how much of this is fictional is, for one thing, Jeff, in a lot of your recent stories, you've been including yourself as a character. Not just under another name, but here's Jeff Ford in this house that's a lot like Jeff Ford's house, and with a wife that's a lot like your wife, and so forth.
Yeah, but you know, the thing is, those are really fiction too. But that's just, I guess, a trick, you know, to draw the reader in. Like, I'm gonna betray some great secrets of myself. Well, you know, people have a very hard time, even professional writers and, you know, reviewers and readers and stuff, still have a hard time disassociating the first person from the author. I mean, I see it in my students all the time, no matter how many times I say it. When they talk about a Poe story and they know a little bit about the background of Poe, you know, the usual anecdotes and stuff, they always assume that the character, the first-person character, they call him Poe, you know, like in the Black Cat and stuff like that. And I find that's true. I find that's true with a lot of people, even though they basically, I don't know, I can't say they should know better, but there's just some inclination to treat the first person as autobiographical, you know?
I know I've gotten in trouble a few times. I'll be reading a short story, and if it starts out with a first-person narrator, my instinct is to assume the narrator's the same gender as the author.
Yeah. That happens a lot, yeah.
That is a universal assumption.
Yeah, and then sometimes, you know, there'll be a gender marker, say, two pages in, and it'll throw me a little bit and go, oh, yeah, of course, there's no reason to assume that before. My bad.
I tell my fiction writing students that if that is not their intention to put in a gender marker very quickly, like the first page, so you...
Yeah, I just wrote a story from the point of view of a young girl in high school, and I was worried about that. I kind of did what Andy said, like made sure I did what Andy was just talking about, because I've written a lot of first-person pieces that could be closely seen as autobiographical, I suppose. And that would really, once things got underway, that would be confusing.
I had a student years ago who read Yeats's poem, An Irish Airman Foresees His Death, and she was writing about it and said, Yeats is remembering back when he was an Irish airman and he did this and that. And I liked that so much, it made me think of this whole, like, alternate world where the Battle of Britain was waged by all the riders, you know, the cockpits of their planes, like, here comes George Bernard Shaw, so forth. I don't think it would have gone as well for the Allies if it had been Yeats and Shaw behind the controls.
But yeah, it is tricky the way you establish voice in a, especially in a short piece, because you don't have much time to do it.
Yeah.
When I'm doing a reading, as I did at the KGB in September, well, actually, it was a male voice I was reading then, but the previous time I was at the KGB, I was reading a first-person piece where the narrator was female. And I just had to announce at the very beginning, by the way, this narrator, you need to know she is female. So do your best to imagine that. But always you have some people that walk in like a minute into the reading and they tell you afterward, I was really confused because I didn't know until very late in the game that the narrator was supposed to be a woman.
Right.
It's interesting with that voice like that. It really is the whole thing. Once you get the voice, the story's there. There's something about that, you know, for me anyway. When I determine what the voice of the character is or the voice in which to tell the thing, that means I understand. I know where that's when I can start writing, when I get that part, you know. I can't really explain it, but that's been the case, I think.
It's the same for me. If I don't know the voice, then I don't know the story.
Yeah, and even third person has a voice, you know?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Even omnipotent third person has a voice.
Yeah.
Oh, sometimes omnipotent third person has the best voices.
Yeah. So
I have a very fond strongness for stories that have a snarky omnipotent third person narrator.
Yes. Because the omnipotent narrator could be snarky, could be sympathetic, could be aloof, could be immersed, could be passionate or cold. But I'm really interested, Jeff, in the stories that have a character named Jeff Ford in them.
Yeah.
Because I agree with you. I think there's a lot of interesting things about that technique. It certainly helps draw people in, and it's something of a way of hiding in plain sight. It's like an amusing sort of subterfuge. I just saw Orson Welles's sort of documentary, although it's not really a documentary, titled F for Fate, which was...
Yeah, I know it. It's great. I love
it. Isn't that great? Isn't that interesting?
Yeah.
And I'm rereading some of your stories in that light because it is a way of pretending that you're being revelatory and opening up to the reader when in fact you're presenting them with yet another fictional character.
Well, thing is too is like you can bring in aspects like details from your life. I got this from Isaac Bashevis Singer. He has this series of stories set in New York that are supernatural. They're not a series, really. It's just stories that he had written. He wrote a lot of them. I love those stories. And he's always himself in them. You know, he's a writer. You always catch the name. Sometimes the name's a little different. But you get this sense that, you know, he's telling you something about his life. And it always begins in some kind of mundane way. He's feeding the pigeons or something like that. And slowly, because it seems like he's telling you about something that just happened a couple of days ago to him, he starts to work in the supernatural stuff, and he gets away with it because you're so invested in the story because you think, all right, he's telling me something that's really part of something that happened to him.
Yeah.
And then when the supernatural stuff comes in, you bought it already, you know? But his stuff was where I really noticed that effect, and I worked on it for a long time trying to get that right.
Mm-hmm. I think it's just fascinating, but I also think it's sort of challenging, or at one time, not too long ago, was really challenging to our field, too. Now, granted, our field, meaning genre SF and fantasy now, has historically been sort of conservative, certainly stylistically conservative. So in the 1950s, people are writing stories with unreliable narrators like Bester, and people are saying, oh my God, this is revelatory, as if it had never happened before. Yes, it hadn't in the genre. But I remember that Orson Scott Card had a story years ago titled Lost Boys, which was about it's a ghost story. But the protagonist is a fellow named Orson Scott Card, who's a writer, who has a wife named Christine, who's living in Greensboro, North Carolina, working for a computer magazine. All these things that we knew were accurate to Card's own life. And then And then in the course of the story, it's about one of their children being killed by a serial killer, and the ghost of the child and all the ghosts of the other murdered children come back. And this was a very controversial story, in part because of the argument that Card had not earned that somehow, that he was sort of suckering us in to make us think this was autobiographical. And then he was just telling us, you know, another horror story.
Well, why do you think they call it fiction? You know who wrote a really great one like that? I remember when I was getting into this, I came across a story by Rick Bowes called My Life in Speculative Fiction.
Uh-huh.
And that's a perfect example of it. It was one of the earlier examples I saw, you know what I mean?
Right.
And if you ever see that around, I think it's in one of his collections, but that's a really terrific piece too. He really gets into it. That's all I'll say. Check it out.
Well, it's the sort of thing I'm tempted to try it myself. I gotta read all these precursors, but I think it could make a really interesting anthology too. I also wonder if it's a move that women writers are as inclined to make as men. Every example we've just listed is male.
Yeah.
Is that act of authorial insertion? We're not quite talking about the what's the fanfic term for the Mary Sue's, the author identification character that you put in to be the heroic best friend or whatever. We're not quite talking about that. It seems to be something. Although maybe we are. I guess the argument could be that Singer and Card are just using this sort of male Mary Sue character to insert in the proceeding.
That gender inversion is known as a Gary Sue. Although, oh man,
I like that.
I like that. I don't.
I would have a. I would get a. Have a character in a story called Gary Sue. That's a great. That's a great name.
Right, like Shel Silverstein, a boy named Gary Sue.
Although, oh, don't get me started on the whole gendering of the Mary Sue accusations and stuff like that, because. Oh man, that accusation gets leveled so much more at female writers, even when they're not, you know, when they're just writing, say, epic fantasy heroines.
You are very right.
Karen, explain that to me, because I'm not really hip to Mary Sue. What is that?
Okay, so the original thing comes from Star Trek fanfic, and you know, back in the day, you know, you'd write Kirk Spock slash or what have you, but sometimes you'd write, you know, Kirk gets it on with random. Say, you know, intern, what was the yeoman? You remember back in the original Star Trek?
Yeah, I remember the yeoman, yeah.
Right, and so you'd have the author whose name was, say, Mary, and she would write a fanfic where Kirk got really attracted to the yeoman Mary, and they got trapped in an elevator, and things ensued.
Ensued?
As it were. And so that act of putting yourself in a wish fulfillment role and again, especially in fanfic, got known as Mary Sue. And apparently, the legend has it, I'm not sure if this is true, that the original person who got, you know, sort of fingered for that, her name actually was Mary Sue. Or well, that, maybe that was the character's name.
Well, I'm living proof that Mary Sue fiction can be written by men, because when I was a teenager, I was in high school. This was pre-World Wide Web, but of course fanfic was still being written before the web. And I was working at a drugstore when I was in high school in South Carolina, and had some time on my hands because it was not always busy at the drugstore. So there were it was a matriarchy I worked in. Everybody around me was a woman, and they were all bugging me to write them a story. So I would write these chapter installments of this, like, ridiculous fantasy epic where I was a character and everybody else was a character. And, of course, I was doing all these heroic things, rescuing all the attractive women and so on and so forth. And it was, you know, I never finished it, and it was just sort of embarrassing to think about. But that was the absolute embodiment of the Mary Sue.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to swoop in and have Debbie notice me. So in the story, she gets carried off by some giant buzzard creature, and I have to go riding off to the rescue.
So, Karen, you said a lot of women writers today are a criticism that's leveled at them?
It is sometimes. So the one that really caught my attention was that Nora Jemison, she, you know, writing the epic fantasy trilogy, Inheritance trilogy.
Right.
And the first book came out, 100,000 Kingdoms, and it's, you know, done very well. And some people started saying that the heroine of that was a Mary Sue. And I thought that was the stupidest thing ever, because basically... Yeah. The heroine of that is the kind of, you know, competent person who gets thrown into a situation and has to deal with it and has a romance on the side. And I'm like, this is exactly the way male fantasy heroes act, but when male fantasy heroes are written that way, no one accuses them of being Gary Sue's for the author.
That's true.
No, but also in those books, the character has, exhibits problems, but the character has failings too.
Right.
So I mean, it's not like, you know, she's not presenting a character who is this, you know, paragon of virtue and, you know, courage and so forth. A character is dealing with the world around her and trying to sort it out, not always making the right decisions. And so, you know, I didn't see that in that book.
I think you're exactly right. And I think the other thing that was going on there is because in the first book, Yane, I'm not sure if that's the right way to pronounce the character's name, but Yane ends up having a romantic association with one of the gods, kind of a fallen god character. And I feel like there's, again, a stigma of when women write romance versus when men write romance. You know, because, again, most, you know, Aragorn falls in love with Eowyn, and you know, most heroes have some love interest somewhere in their epic fantasy. But when a woman writes that kind of romance, then people go, oh my god, you've got an icky girl cootie romance things on my epic fantasy.
Well, this is... may I assume that these were male critics putting these things out or making these arguments?
I don't remember...
It would be tempting to think so, although Lord knows, I mean, those sort of patriarchal attitudes are so ingrained that they can...
Yeah, a lot of times you actually hear it from women as much
This sort of thing is right out of, I won't say her playbook, because she was not endorsing it, but out of her taxonomy of pathology, Joanna Russ's How to Suppress Women's Writing. This is... right out of there. This is a very common strategy to devalue it or belittle it.
Well, I think with the romance end of it, I guess people, you know, have this thing where if a woman's writing a, you know, an epic fantasy where there usually is romance involved in it, that it because it's a woman, it's then too close to the romance field. You know what I mean? Or something like that. Is that the idea? Is that where they're coming from with this, or?
I think that's definitely part of it.
Yeah, I think if readers looked at women short story writers today, that would be abolished. that feeling, you know, that those, because there's so many writers now who could just do everything so well And the thing is, with the short stories, they don't require per se like an epic fantasy does, a romance or something like that. You know what I mean? I think it's a different view of a women writer today. The short stories are so different, and there's so many different voices and different approaches and so forth, that when you get out of that, the accepted tropes like a big fantasy novel or something like that, you could start to see the, women's writing as being something, you know, completely original nowadays, and covering all kinds of fields. That's one of the things I think that's good about short fiction. It takes writers out of those things where all right, here's a big fantasy novel. I'm going to have some romance in here. I'm going to have some adventure. You know what I mean? It gets out of that. Then back to the with the stories, it doesn't have to have any of that stuff for it to work.
What did somebody said years ago that in science fiction and fantasy anyway, that the short story was like the garage where all the kids could take their instrument and just jam and play around and, yeah, and sort of evolve their voices or decide what sort of band they wanted to be?
I have no expectation that when Margot Lanigan writes a story that's somewhat based on a fairy tale, that it's gonna have any of the things I expect from like basic fairy tales. You know, it's gonna have that kind of ending, or the thing's gonna go that way, or it's gonna have a happy ending or something. You know what I mean?
Oh, true that.
Yeah.
Well, you just can't generalize an artist's work by the artist's gender. It's easier to start making some generalizations if they have a shared culture, a shared worldview, a shared artistic community or school of thought that they come out of. But it certainly doesn't cleave along gender lines.
Actually, when I start to see where I could tell what that's going to be in a book, that's when I'm usually not interested in it, you know? When it starts to develop along those lines, that's usually when I get out.
Yeah, I have to admit, there was one book that I was reading. I generally recommend it really highly, but about two-thirds of the way through, I'd been reading it, and it was just, you know, it was very different from anything I'd read before, and I didn't know where it was going, and, you know, loved the tone and the characters and the voice, and it was great. At the two-thirds mark, I went, oh, I know where this is going now.
Yeah.
And I read the rest of it, and I'm like, oh, yep, that's where it went. Huh. Oh, well, I mean, the rest of it's still really good, but that was kind of disappointing.
The Jemison book, I mean, that was kind of a stretch for me. I don't really read large fantasy novels, you know? But when I got into it, it was so unique and so original all the way through the book. I mean, I never really knew what was coming down the pike, you know? That was kind of a revelation in a way of you know, what's possible in that in that kind of a book, in that style of a book. I thought it was very unique in that sense. I didn't have any kind of like foresight as to where it was going to go, but I just wanted to find out, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know there's other books out there like that, large fantasy books that I haven't seen that I probably would enjoy, you know.
Well, and the other thing with Nora is that you wouldn't be able to predict her short fiction from her novels or her novels from her short fiction.
No, and that's the beauty of it, because you could see the range that she has. You know what I mean? With the when you look at the short fiction in relation to those that trilogy.
Well, she's a wonderful writer, and she will long outlive these spitballs that people are pointing at her.
Why? Why are people saying?
She sails past.
are people saying stuff about that book?
Well, it was the Mary Sue criticism.
Oh,
that
really?
Came on early with 100,000 Kingdoms. Like I say, it just pissed me off.
I'm sure she's losing sleep.
Luckily, it appears that she's laughing all the way to the bank. At least I hope so.
Yeah, she can take care of herself.
But yeah, it is great that there's so many venues out there for short fiction, and I know I spent about a year doing short fiction reviews for Cheryl Morgan's Salon Futura. So
yeah.
I really made myself read very widely, you know, venues that I wouldn't necessarily have picked up before and stuff like that. Man, there's just some brilliant stuff, you know, brilliant and incredibly diverse and different stuff being written out there.
It's too hard to keep up with.
Oh, yeah, there's way too much for any one person to read.
Yeah, I try, but it's really difficult to keep up with, you know?
Which is why it's very helpful to have friends, to have reviewers, to have bloggers, to have these various sorting mechanisms, to have award short lists and long lists to help you navigate all that stuff and find stuff that appeals to you. I have been known to read pans of something that made me think, hey, this all the
Sounds
things
good.
That
Yeah, that sounds like me. Everything that's being panned here sounds like what I would like. So I'm gonna find this. So as they used to say in Hollywood, there's really no bad publicity. I'm sure that these nonsensical charges about the Mary Sue with Nora's novels has drawn as many readers to her as it has turned them off.
Quite possibly. Yeah, was it Michael Swanwick who came up with the taxonomy of the good bad review? Yeah, they're good reviews and good bad reviews and then bad good reviews and bad bad reviews.
It sounds like Rumsfeld.
Unknown.
There are those things we know we know.
That's right, yes. Well, Rumsfeld was perhaps not the ideal person in that place and time, but he did speak a language we all understand, I'm afraid.
Mm. It's I saw a term the other day I'd never seen before. Ignoramibus. No, ignorabimus. Have you ever heard this term?
No.
It means what we will never know. And that he was the perfect... he was the ignoramus touting the ignorabimus.
Nice.
I always liked H.L. Mencken's coinage of the bibliobibuli, the people who were drunk on books and words to the exclusion of all else. I sometimes feel that I'm part of the bibliobibuli.
But going back to an earlier thread, one of the things I was thinking, you guys were talking about voice, but there's voice and then there's style. Because one of the things that I've noticed with both of you is that every once in a while, because I'm friends with you both on Facebook, and every once in a while you guys will have just a little status update, and I'll go, wow, that just reads like, again, a little piece of fiction. I even though you're both just writing, you know, in your own voices from things that are just happening, there's something about the style that lifts it from just, say, you know, one little Twitter post to something that feels like it could be out of fiction.
Yeah, you know, I can never really define what style is, because it seems to be taken up by so many of these other things. I mean, the voice and, you know, your vision of the story, and I don't know, I'm not really quite sure what style is. I mean, I'm talking the elements of style, that's basically like a grammar book, you know what I mean? Is it the manipulation of sentences or whatever? That comes out of like the voice and the vision that you have of the story. It's always something that's been like a definition of that has always been confusing to me in a lot of ways.
I am so glad to hear a professor of English literature tell me that.
Well, you know, I had a student the other day in class who'd been in another workshop, and he was using these terms to talk about a story, action tags and stuff like this. And I was like, you know, I was talking to him afterward, and we were talking about, I mentioned that to him, and he said, does it offend you that I use those terms? I was like, I'm not offended by it, but it has a tendency to make it feel like a story is put together by a mechanical process.
Right.
Like, I have all these different elements, and if I just put them together, action tags and some of these other terms he was using, that if you put all that together, you got a story, which... The story always seems to be more than the sum of its parts to me, if it works, you know, if it's good. So, you know, I've been thinking about this, actually, the style thing. I really don't understand. I don't understand it.
I don't either, and I think that's one reason it's very hard to try to teach. There are lots of things you can help writing students with, fiction writing or any other writing, but it is almost impossible to convey to them, for example, that their work sounds stilted and pompous, because they're overreaching. They're trying to use bigger words, more cumbersome constructions that are necessary in the circumstances. And that sort of thing that you just have to have practice as a reader and writer to get is very hard for newcomers to get, because it sort of resists labeling.
And you know, there's a moment, Andy, when you see them sometimes discover, we were talking about voice before, they discover their voice. And then all of that stuff just kind of irons out, you know?
Yes,
And it's not anything like, well, I taught you now where to put the comma and, you know, where to, it has, it's beyond, I don't know, it just doesn't have anything to do with that. It has
right,
to do
it's
with
more, it's more like we just accompanied them on the journey of their discovery. And we kept throwing things in front of them.
Exactly. But when they discover their voice, you can hear it. Like, and a lot of the problems in the writing, the stilted nature of the lines and stuff, it just kind of irons out in a way. It's like they've come to themselves as authors. You know, they're the authority. They're the authorial voice. They get it, you know? I don't know how that happens, but I guess it's the process you're talking about.
I have more than once noticed in a composition class that a student that I thought was hopeless as far as grammar and mechanics will find an actual topic that they're passionate about.
Yeah.
And many of the grammar and mechanics problems fall away, like instantly.
Yeah, well, the thing is like I had a teacher once in school. The only thing I ever learned about teaching from a teacher, you know, in a class about teaching, this guy always used to tell us, you have to pay attention to the individual behind the text. Because he said, where's the writing come from? It doesn't come from their fingers. It comes from their head. When they're screwed up in their head about what they're about to write, they're confused in some way, or they haven't settled their feelings about something, it's going to be reflected in the writing.
Yeah.
But when they get clear on it, or when they have something where there's a real vested interest to them in it, a lot of those grammatical problems just clear themselves up for some reason. Because they have this desire to get it out right, you know?
It's true, and the stylistic problems so often spring from their uncertainties or insecurities.
Yeah.
Like all those, like if they're not confident in their topic, they throw in every sentence, in my opinion, IMHO, this is just me, but if you ask me, and all this other bilge that you can just cross out, just say it.
I remember the first time I ever sent a review to Charles Brown, he sent it back to me with every time I'd said, I think, crossed out. He goes, it's your review. Of course it's what you think.
Yeah.
That's right. It's a very common thing. But you were asking about the Facebook postings. And I think part of that for me is I've long since got used to trying to, within reason, view all my emails, all my Facebook postings, all my online stuff, every sort of communication. As a professional writer, I sort of view all that as part of the professional work, you know. So I try to apply some of the same standards to it.
You're an admirable dude, Andy.
I know. But it's like I can't help it anymore because I realized years ago that I was not confident enough in my own abilities that I could like turn it on or off at will.
No,
but if I ever turned it off and slacked off for months at a time, then when I wanted to turn it on again, I couldn't do it.
Yeah.
So as a result, I mean, maybe I would be more prominent online than I am if I didn't think those ways, but I do have trouble with students when they're writing something for online publication. They write it as if it were a text message to their roommate, so everything's abbreviated, nothing's spelled correctly, nothing makes any sense to anyone but that telepath they had aimed it at, and it's very hard to get them to turn on those analytical tools.
Well, one of the things too is when you write professionally for publication, you're always revising stuff as you go, so you just do that automatically as you write in most things, you know. I mean some of the Facebook posts I know I write them quickly. I noticed as I get older, I leave letters out occasionally. You'll put a couple extra ones in, you know, but yeah, it's just second nature now to edit as you go, to revise. You know, I guess that might be it.
I read it's making the rounds on Facebook, but Liz Hand wrote a little piece on her writing cottage, which is in Maine, which is where she lived for years, but now it's like the home away from home, and it's where she does all her writing. And it's just a few paragraphs describing the photos we're looking at. And I think she wrote it on behalf of a former student who posted it to his blog. But that is as well written. If any of my undergrads had written that, which would have come at the end of a lot of hard labor in the semester, I'm sure, they would warrant an A+ on it. I'm sure Liz, just compared to her novels and so forth, just knocked it out. That may have been the work of an hour. But because she's a professional, I haven't asked her, but surely it didn't take her very long. But because she applies this sort of professional air to everything she does, it's just this luminous little piece. There's like no faltering evidence in it anywhere. There is no stumbling whatsoever.
Yeah.
No hesitation, no indecision. Even though it was written for somebody else's blog, probably in some haste.
Yeah.
But it's not easy writing. If it were easier, more people could do it well.
Man, it never gets easier.
No, it's not.
Sometimes it feels like it gets harder because your standards go.
Well, you know all the stuff you don't want to do. You got to call it stuff you do want to do. Yeah.
But some people just get hung up. That's where writer's block comes from often.
Yeah.
Did you ever experience that, Jeff? Did you ever go through a period where writing...
Did I ever not?
Hard?
No, I mean, I tell you, you know, I write all the time, but it doesn't really mean that it's stuff that's going to get published. I mean, you know, sometimes it takes me weeks to think about a story long enough to write it. It takes me a long time. But once I actually get the idea and I commit to it, then it doesn't take that long, you know? But the thinking part could take years sometimes with a story.
Yeah, it can.
I get stuck all the time. I mean, it's a big pain in the neck. It's frustrating. And I read all the stuff about like what to do in case you get stuck, you know, by all the advice and stuff. None of that shit ever works. You just basically have to wait it out. No? And I should be doing other stuff in the meantime, but I'm just waiting. I sit here and do some. I'm good at waiting. Good at it.
Well, that may be a useful trick right there, because I'm sure a lot of people don't wait. They immediately distract themselves with something else.
If it doesn't feel right, I can't write it. I mean, you know, I can't write something that I just don't feel right about. I just can't do it. You know how like when people talk about like they'll do their own books. What were we talking about Liz before? She'll do her own book and then she'll take a work. You know, she'll do a book like I don't know. She's written, movie.
Novelizations.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, some of those things that the project seemed interesting, like the Bride of Frankenstein one that she did.
Yeah.
But some of it, if I just didn't feel it in me, I don't think I could do it. You know what I mean? I just think I'd probably crash and burn on that.
Yeah, she told me once that she thought that sort of thing was worth taking on only if you were going to do it very quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
And the likes of me, it's difficult for me to commit to doing anything very quickly. Even if I think I'm just going to dash it off, I wind up laboring over it and thinking, wait a minute, what is what is the motivation for the monster to kick the door down or whatever?
I guess if I needed the money more badly, if I wasn't working full time, I would probably get around to it. You know, I remember Scott Edelman telling me he wrote these wrestling books, you know, a book about Stone Cold Steve Austin or something in a weekend or something, you know. Now, when I hear those stories, I'm amazed.
Well, I think that's a very real distinction to make, because both of us with our teaching jobs, and before I was teaching full time, I was doing journalism full time.
Yeah.
And when you've got what my father used to call the good job with benefits in all caps, it really does free you up to be a lot more eccentric, a lot more choosy with your personal writing projects.
Amen for that.
Because you're not worried about the bottom line all the time. A friend of mine who for years was a contributing editor at Rolling Stone told me once that being a freelancer was the hardest job he had ever had, because he was constantly looking, not only working on this project, but looking at the next 10 projects.
Yeah.
And trying to line those up because the mortgage was coming due and the bills needed to be paid and so forth.
Well, and trying to actually hunt people down and make them pay you.
Well, people have always said to me, a lot of people have said to me, like, how can you teach writing? You know, I mean, looking at that stuff all day and then go home and write. But in a way, it's better because it allows me not to write stuff I don't want to, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel that way. Although there are people who are freelancers, I don't know how they put the quality amount of work they do out. I mean, I take somebody like Lucius Shepard. I mean, that guy has written so much great stuff.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? And
that's
he just
true.
Keeps pounding it out. I don't know how he does it. I have no
that's
idea.
That's true. I mean, we're not trying to imply that the freelancers are these miserable hacks. But on the other hand, that they're as Liz Hand could tell us, there are imperatives that take over. I mean, look at all the reviews she writes. I'm sure she's not, you know, moved to her soul by each one of these books she reviews. But those book reviews for the Post or wherever are steady income coming in. Plus, it helps her read widely, gives her ideas for her own fiction, exposes her to work she might not be exposed to, helps her get the word out about deserving stuff that might not otherwise find its audience. So there's lots of reasons to do it, but one of them has to be the check, and very seldom is the check much of a consideration for the likes of me, although Jeff and I spent weeks this fall complaining to one another online about the lack of a check, which we probably don't need to get into. So it's all very well for me to feign being above all this, but I'm as capable as anyone of saying, where's my $25?
Well, you know, I never look askance at what other people do. I mean, basically, the main reason is I don't really give a shit what they do. You know what I mean? It's like, more power to you. I don't really care, though. I mean, however they do it, it's great. I have no whatever kind of books you want to write, whatever way you want to write them, be my guest.
That's right. I think there's a... That reminds me of one of my related themes. I think there's way too much in our field, in our industry, of people like complaining about their colleagues, saying, why is that person only writing this crap genre? Why aren't they writing this good genre? Why are they writing this crap book or that crap book? And I think we spend too much time complaining about our colleagues when we should be looking at how similar we all are, how success should benefit everybody equally. We all should. Well, the moment I said that, I sounded like like Marxist redistribution of wealth, which I don't think is going to happen. But I guess what I meant to say was that it seems to me like when a new talent comes along, like a Nora Jemison, for example, or a Rachel Swirsky, or a Marjorie Liu, you celebrate it. You say, oh my God, this is wonderful. Look at all these new possibilities. Look at these new audiences being brought to the field. look at, like, you were telling us earlier, Karen, about the project that Bear and Stevenson or the others are doing with all these multiple platforms. The Mongoliad. All this is good for the field. It has to be.
Yeah.
But there are too many people whose sort of default setting is to sneer and snipe and complain and say, well, this would never have flown at the Worldcon of 1968 or whatever.
You know, I had a good lesson in that early on. I met William John Watkins, who's a science fiction writer, short story writer, and novelist. He worked at the school I work at, and as my like writing started to take off, he was really kind of in decline. His son had passed away. He was an adult, his son, and it really bothered him. And he never really got around. He couldn't really get back to writing, and I could see it was frustrating to him, you know. But he was always generous and always like encouraging, and you know, was happy to see any kind of like positive things that would happen with my writing. And I could see that he was frustrated by what was going on with him at the time. But I always took that as like, you know, that's the way to go, really. I mean, you know, there's always going to be a new crop of writers, and among them there's going to be great ones. I mean, there's nothing you can do about it. Just enjoy it, really. That's what you can do.
I have to admit, of course, you know, Locus Magazine generally has a policy that, you know, if you can't finish a book, don't write a review of it, and they're often accused of only writing positive reviews. That's not totally true, but you can, you know, kind of see it's a fair point. At the beginning of my reviewing, I tend to think, no, you need to be brutally honest about everything and this, that, and the other, and now I've found it, I just have naturally evolved into, no, I really prefer to just promote works that are awesome instead of spending time with works that maybe don't work that well.
Uh-huh. I don't do reviews. I rarely do I do a review that's going to be published somewhere. But I'll do like introductions to collections and things like that. And I only talk about the stuff that I like. Yeah. I mean, but you know, I think there's times when a negative review, I guess, is called for. I mean, I don't have any problem with that. As long as it's smart, you know. But sometimes the emperor has to be told that there's no clothes, you know what I mean?
And we need more. I'm not dissing the Locus policy. I think there are many good reasons for Charles's policy, which has continued. But I do think in other venues, for example, New York Review of Science Fiction, I'm always happy to see a really smart, really intelligent analysis of something that winds up being, this is really not all that it's cracked up to be, or this has inherent flaws in it, or the popularity of this thing is telling us troubling truths about ourselves or our field. And all that sort of thing is well worth reading, like that, and well worth doing. So I'm not like that great Judith Berman essay a few years ago, Science Fiction Without the Future, that was in New York Review of Science Fiction, about the sort of backward nostalgic gaze at the beginning of the 21st century. And that was controversial, and I agreed with much of it. I didn't agree with all of it, but I thought it was a great read. It was very thought-provoking. I was glad Hartwell and Company published it. But what really gets under my, gets between my eye teeth is just the sort of just the gratuitous snarkiness, and oh well, this can't be any good because she's a woman, or because this writer is only in his 20s, so what does he know, or oh, this can't be any good because Zelazny did it 30 years ago. And you have to read all of Zelazny before you can keep doing it.
I don't mind seeing negative reviews about things, as long as the reviewer takes time to explain what, you know, what the problem is, what the reason for it is. But so many, you know, reviews you see today is like, this is no good, and then you never find out why.
Right.
You know? So there are reviewers, though, who are really more interested in how a book works and, you know, not just it's bad, but what part doesn't work and what the problem is. And, you know, I like to read those things. I learn a lot from those. I'm not talking about reviews of my stuff, but anyone like that, as long as they're thoughtful and, you know, and they get into some depth about it, that I think that's definitely, you know, the way to go if that's the way they feel about the book or that's the experience reading it they've had.
There's things I should have written by now and gotten published somewhere that are, I would hope to be that sort of thing that would have some merit in analyzing why something ultimately does not work. And frankly, I have not written them or pitched them because I'm afraid of running into the people at a convention. I don't want to have that conversation. I'm just a wuss, I suppose.
You trying to tell me something?
No. Not you.
I have to admit, the experience of reviewing changes significantly when you really start to know some of these folks.
Yeah, that must be, I don't know, I guess that must be tough for people too. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think it actually, I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I think it helps me write the kind of review, Jeff, that you were talking about, because if it's a book that I finished and I think is important and worth talking about, but it's flawed, if I'm going to be able to go to a con and look that person in the eye, I need to write that, for one, kind of sensitively, but for two, you know, honestly and with, you know, showing that I've really given it thought. Because, like you say, most authors, they don't necessarily mind a review that admits that a work's not perfect, as long as the reviewer, you know, put the time into it, if you get what I mean.
Yeah.
Isn't just brushing it off or dismissing it with a wave of your, you know, a wave of your hand.
Yeah, and some books that don't work are pretty, I mean, it's not like you wouldn't read them. You know, I just listened in the car to, you know, this book, The Passage?
Yes.
By Cronin?
Yes.
Like, my boss had an extra copy of that, and I have like a 2-hour drive each way. So I said, yeah, I'll check it out. You know, it's like a vampire zombie apocalypto, you know? But it's literary. You know, it got a lot of buzz in the quote unquote literary world, but basically, I got to tell you, man, I've read books that are in the SF genre that were really better, you know, more interesting storylines and stuff. I wouldn't say that this book was a bad book. It was well written, and there were parts of it that were exciting and stuff like that. Parts of it were really corny, I thought too. But you know. I would say to somebody, I was telling one of the students in my class, I thought that, you know, he might like it because he likes vampire fiction, you know. It's not a bad book. I had problems with it, but I wouldn't tell people don't read it. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, it's not like it hurts you to read it. Other people may have a different reading experience.
You know what happens in that book? It's like I felt this way about the movie... You ever see the movie Saving Private Ryan?
Yeah.
Like, that first scene at D-Day is amazing.
Right.
And then, you know, the scene at the end is heartbreaking, right? But all the stuff in the middle is like any other old damn war movie I ever saw. And some of them were better, like Porkchop Hill and, you know, some of the older movies were better. But it's like you have the whole cast of characters in the platoon, and they all have these different problems going, you know
and
what
they
I mean?
Got one by one, like
it's the same damn thing.
Battleground with Van Johnson and
yeah.
Sahara, I saw for the first time a few weeks ago with Humphrey Bogart in the desert.
Yeah, that movie never rises above that, I don't think. But the same thing with this book. I mean, it was touted as this literary work and it got a lot of buzz that way, but you know, it never really rose above like an adventure story with vampires and, you know, and killing and running and stuff. And I've read better ones of those. I mean, like, just, you know, I Am Legend. There's no comparison between the two.
Yeah, I Am Legend is a breathtaking novel. Hey,
absolutely.
And I grieve that so many of my students No, only the various movie versions. And I say, read the novel, read the novel, read the
I dig that Vincent Price version. That's the Last Man on Earth.
Yeah.
That's a great one. There's a scene in that where he's watching these Super 8 movies of his kid's birthday party and the zombies are at the door. Yeah. You know that movie?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Of course, then there's the thing that, you know, reviewing's just so subjective. Sometimes, I remember I'd read the Worm Ouroboros.
Oh, God.
You know, ER edited.
Edison. Yeah.
And I had written a review and pointed out all the flaws, and I couldn't stand it. In the end, I just couldn't stand that book. And then somebody said, hey, you might be interested in this review. And it was another reviewer who had read the same book and identified exactly the same flaws, and he loved it. He loved the book. I mean, we both pointed out exactly the same good points, exactly the same bad points, and in the end, I walked away hating it, and he walked away loving it. I mean, there's just sometimes
that's a realization as a writer. It's better to come too early.
but you both could have analyzed it accurately, and then it comes down to personal taste.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Jeff and I were in some Facebook discussion this summer about Jim Thompson. Because I was reading a bunch of Jim Thompson books at the beach. Because, of course, it's sunny and beautiful and everybody's happy and tan at the beach. So I'm reading about all these miserable dudes, sods, that never go outside where the sun never comes up. But anyway, I really loved the ending of The Getaway. The Thompson novel, which is very different from the Peckinpah movie. And other people were saying, but that end doesn't work at all. It has nothing to do with what came before. It takes it into absurdity, into surrealism. It makes it like some sort of strange moralistic fantasy novel, like this sort of Dantean hell.
Yeah, that's what I like about Thompson.
And that's exactly what I like about it. Everything they said as reasons to hate that ending, I fully agreed with, and therefore I love the ending. It's exactly how it should have ended.
Yeah, those books are brutal, some of them. I read that Pop 123.
Yeah.
That's a crazy one too, man.
That is. I'm trying something odd for me this semester in that I'm teaching a fiction workshop for the first time in a while, 3 days a week. And because I was making the students do it, I committed myself to writing a one-page response to each story. Each manuscript that the students bring in, and that's teaching me a lot. I who knows whether it's teaching them anything or helping them at all, but it's helping me anyway. But one thing that I find remarkable is how when you commit yourself to analyzing the thing well enough to write a page about it, of response, how quickly the I like this and don't like this falls away. It's like sometimes I'll finish the whole write up and I've never quite said whether I like the story or not. which I think is all to the good. Because it's sort of irrelevant if I just say I like this story, I don't like that story. I think it's a lot more relevant if I can say, look at this interesting thing the story does. And look how if it did something else, it would be a very different story by the end. And that sort of analytical thing, which is really not the reductive thumbs up, thumbs down, or how many stars did it get.
How did they like it?
Well,
did they always say, but did you like it?
So far, they haven't. But when we get to one-on-one conferences, they might say that. But I will say in class, I've been very happy with the discussions. Everybody is chiming in and has something to say.
Yeah, that's good.
And they're disagreeing about stuff. So they feel free to disagree with each other.
Oh, yeah.
Which is
gotta establish that. That's good.
Cool. So we've been going for about an hour, so we're probably getting on towards wrapping up here.
Okay.
Big finish.
We didn't even talk about anything like we said we were going to.
Not a lick of it. Of course, when I say, you know, we've been going for about an hour, that's usually Andy's cue to come up with something fascinating that'll go on for another half an hour.
Come up with another 90 minutes in my pocket. Now that we're done with the prologue.
Right, right. But that's what they say about, you know, the genre. It's an ongoing conversation, is what they say.
That's right.
But, of course, the traditional Locust podcast ending is to see if you guys have anything that that you want to let people know, if you've got fiction or books coming out anytime soon or projects that you're working on. Andy?
Oh, well, I have my latest story to see print is the lead story in the Eclipse 4 anthology from Nightshade that Jonathan Strawn edited.
Yeah, it's a good story.
Well, thank you. You have a fine story in there, too. The title of that story is Slow as a Bullet. I've just sold another story to Tor.com, which is my first sale there. And it's titled On 20468 Peter Cook, which is set on an asteroid and everything. I even had to figure out things like albedos and figuring out the size, the gravity of the asteroid based on the size and so forth. But before people think that who is this man and what has he done with Andy Duncan, I should add that the story set on the asteroid is basically a Peter Cook, Dudley Moore routine. And Patrick Nielsen Hayden wrote me and he said, "This is probably the silliest story we've ever bought for Tor.com, but we're taking it anyway."
Hey, listen, what's going on with that story that you and Ellen read at the Florida thing last year?
The ball is in my court and the ball has just been sitting there in the corner getting sort of weedy. But yes, we're still. I would estimate easily 2/3 of the way done with that. I don't think we yet quite have a title for it, but this is our sort of epic about Florida, where we got the idea and where we plotted it and where we researched it, which involves. Oh, it also involves, of course, invasive species and Hollywood filmmaking and the creature from the Black Lagoon and all sorts of things. But my collection is coming out from PS Publishing in 2012. It's titled The Potawatomi Giant and Other Stories. And it has a new novelette in it titled Close Encounters, which is about the UFO contactee movement and UFO researchers of the 70s. So,
cool.
Good stuff. Definitely looking forward to the collection.
And I am too.
And Jeff, how about you?
Well, I have a collection coming out next year sometime. I think around the summertime, called Crackpot Palace. It's got 20 stories in it. I think 20. And it's got a new story in it. It's about 40 pages. I don't know how many words it is. But there's that. Then I have other stories coming out. New Jersey Noir, which is an anthology that Joyce Carol Oates edited. Yeah, nice redundant title, right? New Jersey Noir. I have a story in there called Glass Eels, which is about illegal glass eel harvesting in South Jersey. And I have other stuff coming up. Kessel and Kelly have this book coming out, Kafkaesque, which has all stories in it relating to Franz Kafka's life and work. And I have a story in that that's a reprint, Bright Morning. I did a story for Ellen not too long ago that's coming out in 2012. I think the name of the anthology is After, and it's It's dystopian stories and apocalypse stories, you know, for young adult. My story is called Blood Drive, and it's about it kind of looks at, like, you know how that when they were trying to pass that bill in Arizona for kids to carry guns at school?
Right.
It's about that. But that law has been passed. Yeah. And everybody's packing heat in high school, in their last year of high school. So that was a fun one. And I have there's a couple other ones. I can't even remember what the hell is.
Don't you have one in the new Vandermeer anthology?
There's a story out. Yeah, Relic is in Jeff Vandermeer and Ann Vandermeer's Lamb's Head Curiosities. And I don't know. There's a bunch of stuff out now, but now I can't remember what the hell it is. Oh, I have to. The Drowned Life is going to be in the Oxford Book of American Short Stories in the new edition coming out next year.
Well, that's wonderful.
And I don't know. I just can't remember. There's a bunch of stuff, but I always put the stuff on my blog. I flog it to within an inch of its life, but now I can't remember what the hell it is. Oh, I got a story at the Revelator, which is an online magazine that Matt Chaney and Eric Schaller put out. I don't know if you guys have seen it, but...
I have.
It's called Gaslight.
That's interesting.
It's a little horror story. A little Gaslight horror story.
Oh, and the other thing, Jeff, is if you're flogging things on your blog, you should probably flog your blog as well. So what's the web address?
I don't know. It's Crackpot Palace. I think it's the only blog online that has that title, so you could find it that way. And I'm on Facebook, too. You know, and Andy is, too.
Excellent.
Okay, yes, cool. Track us down there. My fitfully updated blog is beluthahatchie.blogspot.com. Jeff, did the stories in Crackpot Palace, the collection, is that like a career survey, or is it stories since the previous collection? Or
yeah, it's everything since the last collection. A lot of it. Some of it I couldn't get, like Daddy Longlegs of the Evening, I wanted to put in there, but St. Martin's like had this thing in their contract that I didn't realize. I should have read it more closely, but they hold the story for 3 years. That was a new one on me.
That's a lot of time.
Yeah, and it's just everything, you know, it's polka dots and moonbeams and, you know, the Robot General and all those stories are in there. After Moreau. The Relic is in there. Jeff and Ann let me use that one for the book. So, it's 20 stories.
Did Oates recruit you for her New Jersey anthology?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, I guess there's not, you know, I don't think there's that many writers in New Jersey. Well, we had been in some anthologies together. I think that's how, you know, she got in touch with me. You know, Ellen's had her in a couple of anthologies, too.
Right.
You know?
Excellent. Well, I wanted to thank you both for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thanks a lot, Karen. It's good talking to both of you.